And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition, a live edition of The Other Side of Midnight, that magic time between dusk and dawn where everything we know, we think we know when the sun is up. Although, again, now it's becoming more confusing because there's a lot of stuff going on in daytime that only used to be discussed in the hours between midnight and dawn. Before we get going, I want to thank Mike Spent for filling in so ably last night. It was kind of funny because between the other stuff I'm doing, and it'll come out what we're working on. We're working on something so huge. By the end of the program, we're going to be able to tell you what the huge thing is that we're working on, so you got to stay tuned for that. We're in 160 countries and soon to be in a lot more places, so we will get to that momentarily. I did want to begin tonight with an homage to something very, very strange going on in this culture right now. If you look at theothersideofmidnight.com, go to Radio with Pictures. My first item, there is a gunman on the loose in a mall in Seattle. Three are dead. There was a confusing report that maybe four had been killed. An unknown number of people have been injured. This goes, of course, hand in hand with what's going on in Charlotte. Has been going on several nights there. Went on in Tulsa with Terrence Crutcher, who was, literally on the police video, you can see the copter shot, just gunned down. Just an average citizen, SUV breaks down, penalty, death. This is like Orwell. This is like something out of the worst science fiction that I ever read back in the 50s and 60s when the dystopias were beginning to come into favor in science fiction. This has got to change. So, item number two. This is one of the things that can change it. Elon Musk, SpaceX, which had a major on-the-pad explosion a couple of weeks ago, thinks they've now gotten down to a cause, and it's not a UFO. And the reason that's important is because until we can get off this little speck of dust, until we give the human race mental sanity with room, living room, and the contact with who we used to be, what we're seeing tonight playing out in Seattle and in Atlanta and in Tulsa and in Charlotte and in all kinds of other places all over the planet that we don't have time to list because it would take the 2 hours. Unless a game changer is introduced into the human condition, this is not going to change. It's only going to get worse. Think of the report from Iron Mountain. Which brings us to item number three. The U.S. Senate committee today approved the 2017 budget for NASA. Anybody want to take a wild guess at the number of billions of dollars that NASA was given this today by the House and the Senate as per the appropriations process? $19.5 billion. And I'll bet you all think that is just an accident. Well, the game changer that we're going to talk about tonight, completing in terms of the opening part of this series, what my friends and colleagues so ably did last week, we're going to talk about what we found in the solar system and what it means for us. Who the hell are we? And I'm going to begin tonight with a colleague and an old friend. Well, she's not that old, but we've known each other quite a while. And she was in on this from the beginning, so we're going to kind of take a leap back in history, lay a foundation for what we thought we might know then and what we know now. And then in part two of tonight, second hour, bring all my panelists back, and we're going to have an interesting free-for-all, because we're all going to get a vote in what the hell does all this mean. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. There's a last quarter moon up there and a very frosty sky in the land of enchantment, and we shall return. Just one look at you. And we are back on a frosty morning in the land of enchantment. It's actually going down into the upper 40s tonight. I think summer is over. Fall, the equinox. It's amazing how things respond to the equinox. Speaking of responding, I've been trying to figure out this afternoon how long Kinthea and I have known each other. It's like, you know, there are people in your life that you can't look back and think of a time when you didn't know them. And it may be relevant to how we got into what we're going to talk about. But, you know, let me kind of give you the thumbnail sketch here, and we will go from there. Kinthea is known to the early Mars researchers as Mama Mars, lives in the San Francisco Bay Area, and is an artist and the artistic director for the Mars Project and the Enterprise mission. She sculpted the first ever face on Mars, physically sculpted it with clay and all that stuff. Of course, you guys out there in those 160 countries wouldn't know about clay if it's not on an iPhone. There were things like clay, so she made this physical model, along with a feature at Cydonia on Mars called the Cliff that echoes the profiling face features. This sculpture appeared in the first edition of the Monuments of Mars by yours truly, and was later corroborated by computer analysis from Dr. Mark Carlotto at the Analytical Sciences Corporation in Boston. Then came what we called the Cody Mars face, unveiled at the Cody Conference, where she contributed to discussions with other anomalies researchers, including folks that dropped in like John Anthony West. When the Mars Global Surveyor took provocative images of the face on Mars, she set about to sculpt the face once again from that data, including the new information released in the NASA image. That sculpture, the Malta Bronze, was featured on a later edition of the Monuments of Mars book cover designed also by Kinthea. Kinthea organized the first Mars exhibit and was a key organizer of two JPL rallies in protest of NASA's somewhat suppressive policies in this direction. She sculpted a face several more times over the years, creating a 3D computer model later used in the Mars face animation featured on Pox TV. The publisher of Monuments decided to rename her using her original middle name, Lynn, as a last name without even consulting her. Anyway, Kinthea has dedicated more than 17 years to studying and sculpting the face on Mars, along with other analyses of other and now an endless parade of extraordinarily anomalous objects on Mars. Kinthea, welcome to the other side of midnight.
Thank you, Richard. It is definitely a pleasure to be here among other curious minds and forward thinkers. So thank you very much. I'm very happy to join you tonight.
Well, when I'm looking back and I'm thinking when we began looking at this crazy idea that there had been an ancient civilization on Mars, which A, the space agency hadn't thought, you know, we were smart enough to know about, so they didn't tell us, and B, when the images came out, everybody instantly said, oh, trick of light and shadow, trick of light and shadow. So how was it you got to the position, or how did I get you to the position, I guess, where you would tackle this incredibly arduous, backbreaking, literally backbreaking process? So kind of enter the story there. What prompted you to do what the officialdom had not done in 15 years?
Well, at the time, you'll remember, in fact, even at first, when you first saw the Viking face on Mars view, you thought it was a trick of light and shadow. And then DiPietro Molinar sent you a set of photos. And with the two faces, it ignited this excitement. And we were hanging out all the time. And we had all these photos. And there would be photos strewn all over everywhere. And it was you who found something that appeared to have some logical connection to the face on Mars, which brought attention to Cydonia. And at the time, we were all trying to think of, like, well, if you were standing in the city, what would it look like? What would it look like? And being an artist, I thought, well, the only way to know is to sculpt it. And I didn't realize what a task this would be, because what happened?
Well, you were a fine artist. When I met you, you had all kinds of exhibits and, you know, paintings all through the house and all that. But you weren't really a sculptor. But you decided with your artistic eye to basically make a three-dimensional sculpture to see if the trick of light and shadow canard by NASA was in fact true.
Well, yes and no. I wasn't focusing on sculpture, but I had done sculpture during high school. I actually had had a work cast in bronze, and I had actually carved out of soapstone and out of marble. It's just that I didn't choose to focus my attention that way. So there were only a few pieces. But in this, I would say the quantum memory is the quantum memory of having done sculpture. I have that in my, it's innate in me. Mm-hmm. And so when we wanted to know what this object looked like, I thought, oh, it'd be a simple task. But what I didn't realize was how to get to the actual face. And if you look on the images that are online there, the first one there is the different versions of the sculpture. And the second one goes into...
Okay. Everyone goes to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on Radio with Pictures, scroll down, going to have to go kind of far down, to Kinthea's Items. And there's like three long image strips, graphics. Click on the first one, Mars Face Sculptures. And then click on it again. That makes it really big. Okay.
Sorry, that was a huge painting sliding down. Give me one second here. I got to slide it back up. There must be a ghost in the house here.
It's like Mysteries of the Museum. Wow. They come alive.
This is really weird. It's never done that before.
That's what they all say.
Okay, there we go. There we go.
Okay, so we've enlarged number one of your images.
Okay, so there you can see the different versions. And at your leisure, you can take a look at the other one where I go into an analysis. But here's the thing is that first I was just curious to say, oh, how does it look? And I thought, oh, simple, it'll be simple. And I set up a projector on a long board where I could create the two different sun angles. Mm-hmm. And I would sculpt until I got it just to what I thought it would look like. And then I would photograph it. And then I'd bring it into the computer and put it alongside the NASA, let's say, the low sun angle, and get it just what I thought was precise.
Mm-hmm.
And I would see where it matched and where it didn't match. And where it didn't match, I was resculpting. Okay, so cool, wonderful. Then I moved the projector to the other sun angle. And what happens? It doesn't look at all like it. So then I'm sculpting again, and I'm sculpting again. And I get it to where I think it's sort of like that, and I take the pictures. I can't tell you how many hundreds of pictures I took. Bring it into the computer. Does it line up? Does this match? Does this not match? Okay, sculpt. Then, all right, they think you're done. Go back to the other sun angle. It doesn't match again. So it was this back and forth,
back and forth. This went on for weeks. I remember you complaining about your back.
Yeah, because I had to lean over this sculpture to get, you know, I had to have the sun angle, the light projector. I had to see it the way the NASA photo was appearing. So it wasn't like I was standing up sculpting it. I was leaning over all the time. But what I want to say here is it was a really delicate balance to find where those two light angles were intersecting with each other. Back and forth. And this process happened with each of the evolving Mars face sculptures.
See,
that
this
I
was
did.
So crucial because behind what you were doing, NASA was publicly saying, and even people like Sagan were saying, it's just a trick of light and shadow, that it had no three-dimensional face-like attributes. And this incredibly painstaking back and forth, reducing the error, you ultimately proved with this 3D analog clay model that the damn thing was a three-dimensional statue. Oh, by the way, it happened to be a mile long and 1,500 feet high and all that, but it was a statue.
Well, and also the other thing is, you know, at that time, there were a lot of people who thought we were just, you know, out to la-la land. So I had to convince myself, too. It wasn't just sculpting the sculpture. I took those images, NASA's images of the face, and I analyze them, trying to see, okay, is there a symmetry here? If what lines up, what doesn't? And even though the face is not symmetrical in terms of like mirror-like, the basic structures of it are symmetrical. And you can see that in the second long panel where I'm doing analysis, that the mathematics, the plateaus that are going around and so on, they were symmetrical and they were lining up.
Well, this thing sits on a platform. It's just bizarre how it sits neatly on this platform, and yet it appears to have two different, I don't know, representations on each side, like the appearance.
Yes, right. And this was kind of what evoked in us the thought, well, I wonder, it kind of looks, you know, when we would take the mirror and kind of would say, on that other side sort of looks like a lion. And then, bam, it dropped in. Well, the Sphinx, it's human and feline. And this connection of, like, the humanoid feline features has been haunting the Mars face question. It because it brings to mind, well, what is the question or the connection between Earth and Mars? And I remember you did some calculations about the Earth rising up behind the face on Mars. You know,
yeah,
added to that magic.
They're called precession calculations. And they're based on mainstream work that was coming out of NASA. So what we did is we plugged in the angles. If you stood in the center of those pyramids, we called the city, and looked across the face several miles to the east as a kind of a profile, which is what your model shows, what would you see behind it? It turns out that 500,000 years ago, the face would be kind of homage to the Earth going around the sun like a brilliant planet, setting and rising behind the face on Mars, standing in the center of those pyramids. So that was my provisional age based on the alignment data, based on what it would have looked like based on your sculpture if you had stood there and watched the Earth 500,000 years ago rise behind it.
Yes, and the other thing that was like a magical surprise that came out of sculpting this was that there was this feature behind the face called the cliff. And if you look at it, it's very strange. You know, you see a crater and then you see this object sitting on the edge of the crater that obviously was put there, came there after the crater was
created. Yeah, this very long,
linear
feature. It goes across the flow marks. It's definitely later.
And so we just sort of thought it was a kind of a random shape. But as I proceeded to do the same thing with that and sculpt it, one day I was picking it up and I lifted it up to eye level, like if I were in the city looking out to it. And this huge like awareness dropped in and I said, oh my God, it's a profile of a face too. And then I looked at the face on Mars in front of the cliff behind, and it was like it was echoing it or framing it. And I thought, oh my God, I'm the first person on this planet who's seeing this. It was like being teleported. I can't tell you the energy and the electricity that came off of that moment. And then when I showed it to the other researchers, you know, it was like it became even more obvious.
Wow. So the whole tableau was meant to be seen from those pyramids that we call the city.
It seems that way. You know, it definitely seems that way. Of course, we are exploring it here, but everything that I am convinced, as the more and more I look at these Martian features, not the fort, there are just so many of them that they are artificial. You know, I've had to, in my own personal life, go a solitaire, you know, because it's not like the circles of people that are around, you know, all think about civilization on the planet Mars 500,000 years ago, you know. It doesn't work that way.
It does kind of spoil you, yes.
Yeah. So we were like a band of It was like an electric time. Each of the researchers, Carlotto and Van Flandern and McDaniels, you know, each researcher was bringing in their expertise in trying to solve this puzzle, and the camaraderie in those early times was electric, was absolutely electric. And I remember at the CODI conference when we were all around discussing what things could be, and the enormity of it, and what I kept hearing from all the researchers is how many obstacles they were encountering in their own fields, you know, from their own peers. And I realized, you know, these men who were in professional fields, what a lot of courage it took for them to come forward. You know, I'm an artist, you know, so it's not like I have some big career to lose. People expect artists to be forward thinkers, but these...
Well, Dr. McDaniel was there at Sonoma State. He was what's called an epistemologist, which is the science of how do we know what we know. And he came at this from a very logical perspective. He just looked at what NASA was doing. He looked at the worth of what we were looking at. And he wrote a whole book on the basis of the fact that, you know, NASA was not being logical. It was just not, it was not being forthcoming. By the way, did you ever, if we go back to Radio with Pictures, go to, again, theothersideofmidnight.com, click on Radio with Pictures, scroll down under My Items to item number 4. Did you ever see this?
Oh, you mean me?
Yes.
Oh, well, my computer just went to sleep, Richard. I'm sorry.
Uh-oh, well, hit it again.
I'm waking it back up. I'm sorry. You know, I didn't
see, in no other period in radio could you get away with saying, oh, my computer just went to sleep.
And of course, oh, now I've typed in my password 3 times trying to wake it up.
Oh,
okay.
Number 6 under My Items there, Radio with Pictures.
Yeah. Okay.
Tell me when you got it.
Okay, I'm in now. See your items. So that would be above my
items. Yes, above
items,
yours. Yes.
Okay.
So, number 6.
So 1, 2, 3, 4.
They have little numbers under them. So
not on my page, but it's it's a horizontal one.
No. It says, keep going. Number 6 up higher. It's the composite of the face.
Oh. Okay.
You see it?
The one that looks like sunrise?
Well, it's a composite. It's a left and a right. And it's in color. And it's number 6.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't see a number 6, but I see the
Okay, now this, is this an image you is familiar to you? Because this is so bizarre. This is in terms of composition. The left hand of this, this is a composite of a black and white image and a color image from 2 different missions. The left hand side is from Mars Surveyor. The right hand side is from a spacecraft called Mars Odyssey, which had a color camera called Themis. And they took a pretty high-resolution color. So what I did was, that was the only image ever taken from the Odyssey spacecraft of dawn with the sun rising in the east.
Mm-hmm.
But the sun is not up yet. This is what it looks like when the sky is lit before the sun is up.
And yes, all that, and why is it so luminous?
All that luminous color and all those different prismatic thingies... It says to me, glass, that's the protected side of the face on Mars. And after all these years, this image gave us the idea, based on the optics, that the right side, more preserved from erosion than the left because of the winds, it actually is made of, among other things, glass.
Hmm.
Look at that.
Well, what I love about it is also you can see the symmetry of the face, even if they're not totally identical. You can see that the structure of the face has composition and form.
And look at the glasses arranged in geometry. You know, you have parallel things and right angle things. And, you know, mm-hmm. In other words, if you're building a huge statue, which is over a mile long and 1,500 feet high, it's not going to be solid. You're not going to sculpt it like you did your little model. You're going to make it hollow. You're going to build it. You're not going to sculpt it. So this data says the damn thing is hollow, It's made of subsections. It's made of geometric structure. And there's some glass on the surface that is just amazing pre-dawn when you take a color picture.
It's spectacular for sure.
So I'll tell you what, we've got about a minute here till the bottom of the hour, maybe not even that. When we come back, I want to talk from your perspective, culturally, how you think this now fits into to what we've learned over the last 30 years when we've been doing this, because we've learned an awful lot, and we will get to that. My guest this morning, Kinthea, she is the artist of the Enterprise mission, the original Mars project, known fondly... Like Gene Roddenberry was known as the Great Bird of the Galaxy, well, Kinthea is known as Mama Mars, as you're going to hear in the next part of our conversation. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Planet's broken. Can I fix it by myself? The plan has broken. You're going to need a little help.
Back on the other side of midnight on this Saturday morning, end of the week. We've survived another week, and next week is going to be absolutely beyond belief. So get ready. We're going to talk toward the end of the show about some of the things that are going to happen here. We're going to try to prepare you for what's happening there, meaning anything that's not here. So, Kinthea, we have more images on the on Radio with Pictures, so let's go back to images, and we'll kind of creep up on meaning. But see, to me, as we kept going through these iterations, I got more and more ideas about what the heck was going on in this place. So where should we go next? Number three?
Yes, that would be the rallies.
Americans
for Open Planetary Research.
Oh, you got to give people the background on this.
Well, okay. There were actually three rallies, two of which I was a key organizer together with David Laverty and Jim Grassroot. They contacted me. It was funny because David contacted me so reluctantly. He thought I was like some famous person who might deign to talk to him. I just laughed when I heard that. But he in our circles was known as Guido. And he would pull off these secret missions at night, like plastering the New York Times place with Mars photos and so on. Anyway, the three of us were not very happy with what was going on with JPL in the images. And so in November of 1996... while you were at Cape Kennedy in Florida and we were in Pasadena, we were pulling off a rally. And this composite of images is of the two rallies. And there was a third time we went down there to JPL. And there were so many Mars enthusiasts who came and joined us. And I remember the night before the rally, Jim and I, we were in Jim's garage creating these big signs and painting signs, and, you know, so we would have stuff for them. It was like this, you know, mission that we were on, because we really wanted to wake up public attention to what was going on. And
well, no one had ever demonstrated about space. I mean, the networks actually covered it because they were mind-boggled that enough people gathered in those, you know, plazas in front of JPL that afternoon and those mornings actually cared and gave enough of a damn about it that they would make a political issue. And so, yes, it got a lot of coverage.
Right. And at one point in one of the rallies, I think it was the one in 97, The police had come trying to stop us, and further down in the image you see that they're the police and they're talking to us. And so I said, well, you can't arrest us for walking the crosswalk. So we started walking back and forth in the crosswalk. Every time the light would turn green, we'd walk across with our signs across the traffic, wait on the other side, and then walk back. It was...
Oh, it's about halfway down. It says Trev Brody reporting. I guess that's an L.A. local station.
Yeah,
there you are.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it obviously had an effect, because when the Mars Surveyor spacecraft was sent to Mars, Malin initially had not planned to even go anywhere near Cydonia, and they finally had to take pictures based on these public demonstrations, and me doing a lot of lobbying on Art Bell.
That's right. And that MGS photo would never have come through if it hadn't been for all the pressure that they were receiving from the public that wanted to know. We wanted to know. And you know, here's what I want to say, is that many times I've met people who saw the original book cover, and I would get this response. You know, it reminds me of something. It's so familiar. And I remember talking to astronaut Brian O'Leary, and he had mentioned having a memory of being on the planet Mars. And so when you look around the Earth, Markawasi, a huge, you know, island-type base, and the Sphinx and other features around the Earth that echo what we seem to be seeing on the planet Mars, it begs the question, well, really, who were the Martians? Mm. Well, who are we?
Well, exactly. You know? I mean, did you ever hear the numbers I did on the probability that the face on Mars and the Sphinx at Giza here on Earth are, you know, have the same symbology? Remember, man, lion, or hominid
right,
lion?
Right.
And then the sine of one is equal to the tangent of the latitude of the other, and the odds of that happening by accident are kind of like 7,000 to 1. So you've got two places on two different planets that are talking to each other symbolically and artistically, and one of them just happens to be a mile long.
Yeah, it's awe-inspiring, honestly. That's what captured me, is that every time I would look at that photo face, a face only a mother could love, by the way, when I would look at that face and ask myself, well, are you real? You know, I went into this almost trying to figure out, well, are you real or are you not? You know, am I just making this up? And the more that I studied it and immersed myself in it, it became a silent language. There's what we say with words, but there's also what we intuit with our quantum faculties, if you will. And this memory factor that I kept encountering, not only in myself, but in the other researchers, or in the public when we would go out and do the rallies, what we would hear from other people in the public as they would stand around and look at these photos, it was familiar in some sense. And I can't help but believe that there is something in our DNA code. There's something that echoes, that carries a memory to it. And it's, when I say it's a nonverbal language, the great inventions that have come on this planet, they didn't come through words. They came in a swift, intuitive knowing. Something like an insight comes through and the inventor follows through on that. And it's that kind of impulse. It's a nonverbal impulse. It's an instinct. It's rooted deep inside the primal core of who we are. And, well, it's that question that kept driving me throughout the years to rigorously discipline myself to explore this. I mean, as an artist, I have always chosen to be, you know, unencumbered and free and creating my art and really go out there. And here I was, in a sense, tying my hands to being religiously or disciplined to not fudge on what I was seeing. In fact, when I had been going through the details from the Viking's high image and in my sculpture, okay? So when the Mars Global Surveyor image came out and it didn't have the correct contrast, everyone called it the cat box because it just looked like sand and everybody was saying, oh, NASA bombed it. Oh, NASA did this and that. And as I looked at it...
Well, you know where that name came from, didn't you? It came from Art Bell. The night that this image was published all over the world, Art had me on. And, of course, Art loves cats. And he just come from the bathroom, apparently, where they were testing out some kind of new automated cat litter thingy, which scares the hell out of cats. And he said, good God, Dick, it looks like something, in my cat box. And that's
exactly
why it became called the cat box image, because Malin did everything he could to take that image at the wrong angle, the wrong lighting, the wrong season, the wrong everything.
Well, what I really want to emphasize here is among the Mars circles, everyone was saying that NASA had in some way damaged the actual face on Mars. And as I looked at it and I saw the details there, I could trace them into my model. And I spoke up and I said, no, everything is there. It's just that the contrast is incorrect.
Yeah.
All the things that I was seeing in the Mars Global image, it was in my sculpture.
See, this is what I loved about what you did, because you took your whole artistic background and you focused it on a scientific methodology of proving in a 3D model using the best data we had, a stereo pair, two separate images, two separate angles, two separate sun angles, that the damn thing really was a statue. So then when some of these crazy people, and I would get them myself, they would call me up and say, hey, Hoagie, they went and they nuked the face. You were able to do point by point and show, no, Malin just took it under the worst possible conditions at the worst possible angle so everybody would think it was not real.
Right, right.
Gosh, NASA, actually playing with people's consciousness in science. You'd never believe that. So looking back now, I mean, you guys had a kind of a love fest the other day when I wasn't able to be here, and we're going to have one again, I think, toward the end of the show. We're going to talk about everybody looking at what this means. But what do you think now, looking back over all those decades, when you look at all this junk lying around in these curiosity images, there is zero doubt, zero, 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 zero doubt that there was not an ancient civilization on Mars, maybe more than one. And what do you, when you look back in terms of the work at Cydonia, how does that make you feel that, damn it, we were right, us crazies, we're right.
Relieved.
Well, how can you be Mama Mars if there's nothing on Mars to Mama?
Right, you know. Oh, my God. No, she's not crazy. It really is there. No, I want to say something also is that as we were looking at what was there on Mars, sometimes I would ask myself, I wonder if this is one of the Garden of Edens, because in Genesis, in the Bible, it's like the Garden of Eden story starts up and then it starts up again. And I always wondered, well, I wonder if that was perhaps the first Garden of Eden.
Oh,
if maybe the story was not just Garden of Edens here on planet Earth, but maybe a continuation of the Garden of Edens.
Interesting.
So that's been a question mark in my mind for many years.
Well, there are lots of textual connections to where you might actually think if you look at the original Hebrew, and I should have Stan Tenen on to talk about this, but there's an awful lot of Hebrew which has what you would think Martian overtones in some of the language. For instance, the Earth, the Red Earth. What planet do we know if you form creation, humanity, consciousness by breathing spirit into Red Earth? What planet has an awful lot of Red Earth? See, that kind of thing. So the implications that come with this data, now that no sane person can look at these image after image after image after an image and say it's not there. So then you get to the extraordinary position of, what the hell does it mean? What does Sidonia mean to you? I mean, we've got some friends that are thinking some pretty awesome things about Sidonia. As an artist, when you look at Sidonia and realize now they, whoever they were, did it, how does it strike you?
Oh, it's like touching an ancient memory that resonates a chord of awareness. And it's a wake-up call. It's like, okay, let's be more conscious. We don't want to repeat what happened there. Mm. It's a wake-up call. And I feel that's why it's so timely that now it's getting attention again, because our Earth is on an edge right now, and we need that wake-up call. We need that wake-up call. And so as an artist, all my art is really focused on consciousness. That's really been what my key driving force in everything I do. And it's not that I have the answer. It's that I like to ask the questions. I like to open up the questions. And so Mars is that giant question mark for me. It is echoing the possibility. It can't be ignored now. And what is it going to mean as information around the world goes that, yes, there was an intelligent civilization on this other planet? Things are going to have to be reevaluated. Things are going to have to be renewed, resurrected, big mind shifts. And I don't think it's going to come easily, because change is not normally greeted or welcomed. Change is like resisted. And so I feel that the artist's role in our culture is to be like a spearhead on a rocket, to open up the possibilities. That's what Star Trek was about, great art. It opened up the possibilities in our minds of what was possible, and it echoed most likely what has been, maybe not in precise detail, but the core messages there are true to the heart. You feel it in your heart. And I feel that the question of Mars, I will say, the research has been very much dominated by men and looking at all the artifacts, and it's a very linear kind of process. But going parallel with this has been an intuitive process that I see happening, not only for myself, but anyone who encounters these images, that it's waking up the quantum self, the consciousness, and it's resonating that deeper knowing, and I feel that it's activating the core heart energies. And so that's why it holds my attention. It's not just a barren, desolate planet. It has the seeds of a consciousness in it, and what that could mean in terms of waking up and saving our planet. And the heart energy there, I think it opens us up to a greater spiritual knowing that we as a species are not alone in the universes. And
the thing that I find,
there is a field.
Mm-hmm. The thing I find so sobering, and I've felt this for literally decades since I first realized in that little den there in Berkeley, in my little cottage, as I said, all alone except for the clock and the cat. And I realized this was real because I saw the first geometry that could not be natural. And we've amassed now a tremendous amount of evidence that says, yes, there's a planet littered with the remains not only of one civilization, but many. Like, for instance, if you go to the other side of midnight, click on Radio with Pictures, scroll down under my items to number 5. This was spotted early on in the Curiosity mission. Just photographed by one of the cameras, and it's, when you look at it, it's in this agonizing question again, is it just a trick of light and shadow? It looks like a very male statue with maybe a crown, lying buried in the sand like Ozymandias. Remember that incredible poem by Shelley? And in the background looks like some kind of architectural cornice from the top of an iconic column or something. And it's just lying there like Ozymandias, so incredibly evocative. And if you go in and zoom very closely, you can see that NASA very carefully pasted in the shadows so you cannot see if the image on the left is mirrored by the reflected light of the statue that's not buried in the sand on the right. And you can see details in other shadows. This shadow they painted in so you can never know on this data whether it is truly a bisymmetrical face. But when you look at all the detail that you can see there, would you not agree, Kinthea, as an artist, that that damn thing has to be a statue?
Well, it certainly feels that way.
Does it?
You know, it perks my curiosity, definitely.
Now, the fact that it's
definitely
so eerily familiar, it's like something you could see in Athens or see in Egypt, mm-hmm. including the architecture behind it, that cornice. This feels so much like not an alien culture, but a human culture. It feels like us, all the way down to a statue lying in the sands 2,000 miles away from the mile-long face on Mars. We're looking at artwork that's communicating across the millions of miles and the millions of years. And what the hell were they trying to say?
Right. Whew. Strong. I want to take this opportunity, Richard, to also point out that there are some, to experience the face on Mars, there are some animations on the pictures where the small pictures are. It says Kinthea's YouTube,
okay.
And that is three animations. And I just want to make sure that the audience knows that that's there. They can look at it at their leisure. There's a fly around the face on Mars with a 3D model that I created in the computer and was animated by Fred Torres. And then there is the tube, which is an experience in itself to look at that animation. But then one of the other images I have was an experiment I did to match these tunnels or tubes that are on the planet Mars. And you'll see the NASA photo, and then you'll see in the animation what it looks like. So you've got the sunrise, sunset, and you've got the fly around the Mars face, which is an experience in itself, and you've got the tube animations. And the music was music that I created together with Richard Kaplan, an amazing musician. And I just wanted to make sure to get that in because Fred has done fabulous work. And you will get a feeling of being on the planet if you watch that fly around, the flyover. It will really, I think, move you.
Okay, I'm taking a look at one of them. Oh, my. Oh, look at the texturing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, we created a texture map from the actual Mars Global Surveyor image.
So, okay, we got a few minutes to the top of the hour, and then we're going to bring the gang on, and we're going to all have at this. But in the period of time when there's no competition, what do you think happened? What are we looking at on Mars?
I think we're looking at the big lesson. Painful as it may be. But exciting too.
Okay, there are what, three videos in this sequence? In this link, I think. Okay. Oh, they're really amazing. This was you and Fred Torres who did this.
Yes.
You can make them full screen. I mean, what's eerie to me is how the computer model, which is a lot simpler and does not do things to your back, looks like the clay model. In other words, the very idea of analog and digital meshing, of giving the same answer. And remember, in the beginning, everybody listening to the sound of our voice, they thought we were nuts because NASA said it was a trick of light and shadow, and it was so hard to overcome the idea that it had to be a trick because nothing like that could be real on Mars. And of course, now we know there's so much else at Cydonia. I mean, have you seen some of the detailed analyses that Keith Laney has done with the incredible geometry and the depressions all around the D&M pyramid? And then the comparative work that Andrew Curry did to compare like surface artistic views of what that geometry would look like. I mean, we have so much data now over what we were working with way back then, but it is interesting that we seem to have nailed it.
Yeah, and you know, for me, an exciting thing was on the very first face on Mars that I sculpted. It was Dr. Mark Carlotto who came in and did a simulation afterwards on the computer, which confirmed what I had created. And I thought, wow, that was a shocker, because, you know, computers were just getting going in those days. And to have someone come in and verify it was like, wow.
See, that's another thing. When we started this, which was something like 30 years, does it feel like
more 33, like more like 33 or so.
Oh my God, you know, where does time go? None of the appurtenances we now take for granted, Photoshop and YouTube and Google and global social media, none of that existed.
we were doing the researchers, we were connecting on the old computer where we just had little black and white little like text messages going back and forth, and reams of paper with these little text messages coming through.
And you couldn't send images. You couldn't, you know, the bandwidth, it was totally, you know, it was dial-up modem, for God's sake. So this was really, you know, evoking another line from Star Trek, it was kind of like stone knives and bearskins.
So when Dr. Mark Carlotto came forward, that was like, wow, you can do that?
And remember how he made a 3D and then we rotated it around, and then I got this idea of putting it at the front on the first several dozen pages. When you open the Monuments of Mars, it's kind of like one of those flip cards where you scroll, where you use your thumb and you scroll the edge of the page. You'll get this little flip animation of Mark Carlotto's three-dimensional rotating model of the face on Mars that matches Kinthea's hard copy in three-dimensional clay.
And by the way, matches the animation that you'll see in that YouTube video.
So, hold it there. We're at the top of the hour. We have a short station break. You're on the other side of midnight, everyone. When we come back, we're bringing the gang, the imaging gang, and all their diverse opinions about what the heck have we stumbled over. And then, the more important question, what are we going to do about it? Because just us guys knowing about this, it doesn't mean anything. We've got to diversify and democratize this, as you'll hear in the next hour. You're on the other side of midnight, and we shall return. Don't go away.
I'm your captain. I'm your captain. All right. Though I'm feeling...
I don't want to talk about things we've gone through, though it's hurting me. Now it's history.
And we're now into our second hour on the other side of midnight on this Saturday morning, August 24th. August, what am I saying? September 24th. See, it's still Mercury retrograde, so I take no responsibility. ABBA in the background. So let me introduce the gang, because you know them by now, our imaging team. Kinthea, you've already met this morning. There's Keith Laney, Will Farrer, Tommy Jensen, Andrew Curry, Chris Maroney, and way over across the pond, Robert Harrison. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the other side of midnight.
Good morning, Richard.
So I'll tell you what, we've got about 5 minutes here before the next break. If everybody can do it really quickly, go through how you each got intrigued with the idea of a civilization on Mars. Keith, you start first.
It's almost like I always knew this, Richard. I remember being in grade school and writing a paper about a missing planet. But actually, the first time I actually got a real inkling of it was when this crazy guy with immaculate hair showed up on CNN pointing at it.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, hang on. Will, What grabbed you about this crazy idea?
I might have to admit that it was ever since I was a young child, I felt a connection to Mars. And when I listened to you out on the other radio shows that you were doing and picked up your book, as well as J.P. Skipper, give him some credit too. He had a great website out there for a while. I was sold.
Okay, Tempest is Fugging. Thomas?
Hey, hi, everybody, and thank you for letting me on your show, Richard, here. My thoughts on the civilization on Mars is, ever since childhood, I've been fascinated by the universe, not only Mars, but I do believe that some of us comes from or have some origins from Mars in one way or another.
Oh, interesting.
Started
okay. All right.
All the way from childhood.
We'll get into that after the break, okay? Andrew.
Richard, I used to read as a little kid a comic book that was a basic space war with motherships and fighters, and I would play hosts the planets, especially Mars, and I would read my comic book religiously when I was a little kid listening to Mars.
Amazing. I think I'm seeing a pattern here. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, I got to agree with the others. I always had this link. You know, it just felt like, you know, you were a part of Mars kind of thing, and then later on in life and looking at all these photos, and it just seemed to confirm it, you know.
Robert? Mr. Harrison?
What was the question, Richard, that got in late?
What got you into this? But that's other crazy people.
Oh, it was a little photograph in Carl Sagan's Cosmos of the pyramids of Elysium.
Oh. Yeah, these huge tetrahedral mile-sized pyramids on the other side of the planet from this place called Cydonia. So, all right, here's the pattern I see. Every one of us, and I have to account myself here too, every one of us who took this seriously and asked what could it be real and then followed the science to make sure that it was real, we all believed it could be real. Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, that the people that we talk to who don't see it because they never imagined they would see it? And hold it there. We're 5 after the hour. My guest this morning, too many to count. We'll do that when we come back. I'll give you Facebook and Twitter info and phone numbers to join if you want to pop in a question or a speculation. You're on the other side of midnight, and we're tackling the question in this hour, are we the Martians? We shall return. And on a moonlit evening, early morning from the Land of Enchantment, with Stevie Wonder in the background. Okay, everybody, again, this pattern is intriguing. Everybody who's involved in this, like we are, also believes it's not only potentially possible, but maybe even likely, that one of, or not maybe more than one of, our many, 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 many lives in this reincarnative model actually may have been spent on Mars. So I think it was, Thomas, I think you were saying something like that.
Yeah, I talked about that we could be originated from Mars and a lot of other planets. Our universe is so big, so if Mars would be the only place that the humans came from or was, how to say it in English, created from of being a part of, and then it would be weird to me if it was only Mars that we came from. But I believe that part of us originated from Mars. There are many angles to look at it. There is a spiritual angle, and there is a physical angle. There are a lot of ways to how you can perceive this topic.
Okay, so by the way, somebody is building a house in the background there. They got to stop doing that, okay? Did you have these feelings before you saw this data, or was it the Was it the feelings, the inspiration that made you kind of pursue the Mars data and ultimately find what you found?
I have had this feeling since I was a childhood that there was more in our universe than we were able to understand with our human minds. It's an intuition I have had since I was a little child. And when I grow up, I'm born in 1977, exactly my birthday today.
Oh my God, happy birthday!
Thank you. When I started in school, I remember seeing the face on Mars from Cydonia for the first time, and I was fascinated by it. And my intuition right away told me that there was something to this, more to this than we have been told or than we see in the picture or than the information we are given by NASA. And as a little child, you don't do research as such. You do that when you grow up, and so did I. I started 10 years ago about doing my actual research on this topic, and I do believe that there is life on Mars, and there was civilization that is or is civilization on Mars that are way much more technology. They are way ahead of us in technology and knowledge. Sorry, my English. I have to find the words. I'm not speaking normally.
So this is interesting, because if you hadn't had that feeling that you might not be totally from here, you wouldn't have had the feeling to go looking.
That could be a good point you're having. I always had the feelings that we were not from this planet. This planet is seen with a spiritual view. This planet is a school, so to speak, for souls to reincarnate, and some of those souls have been on Mars, some of those souls have been on other planets in our solar system, planets that we probably not even are aware of yet.
But we will be at some point. Okay, let me move this around then. Andrew, how did you get involved in this? How did you decide to look up, really up, in terms of art?
Well, again, Richard, I think it just began very early when I was very young. And I know for me, you know, besides reading books like Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury, which I found very comforting because it seemed, again, very familiar even as a youngster.
Well, see, let me stop you there. But when I was looking at the Mars stuff, as Kinti and I were discussing a little while ago, I was struck again by this overwhelming familiarity. Yeah. And I got this sudden shocking thought one night, oh my God, what did Ray know and when did he know it? Because Ray Bradbury, when he laid out the Martian Chronicles, the bottom line of all the stories assembled into his novels, the Martian Chronicles, was we have met the Martians and they is us. So then the question is, I'm looking at more and more of this stuff, and of course it's really come out in the last couple of weeks, is we're looking at basically a Martian junkyard. Was it us? Are we looking at us? And as Cynthia then said, if we are, what a hell of a cautionary tale.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we've noticed, look, you can throw a dart. If you're standing on or floating up above Mars' surface right now, you could throw a dart or shoot an arrow, and you're going to hit something artificial.
Yep.
And one of the things that we've noticed, and I know there's this word pareidolia that's just thrown around, and we get a lot of people sort of tossing that our way. This whole idea of a trick of light and shadow and recognizing patterns. I mean, Keith has a really great concept. He goes, well, you know, it's like a plug in a wall. It looks like a face because it is a face because it's supposed to let kids know not to put their fingers in it because it's a big mouth open. So, I mean, it's the same thing on Mars, not that it's a plug-in. But, you know, look, you could have some of these things be tricks of light and shadow. We can see like an old face in the side of a cliff here on Earth. But when you see these faces over and over again on Mars, or what look like faces, and not only that, Richard, but many, many cultures are represented. There's a multitude of artistic styles. We see stuff that looks Mesoamerican, and I'm sure Keith is going to talk about that. We see Egyptian, we see Hindu, like the Cambodian temples, and I mean, I've even think I see something that looks like a classical Greek or Roman piece. So if it's all tricks of light and shadow, and those are only just the artistic forms or the worn down artistic forms, we're seeing stuff that looks mechanical. And the biggest ones are the structure, is the masonry that you see over, well, what seems to be like masonry over and over and over again. And Richard, another thing about these mounds, and it's something that Keith has really brought forward with his Gigapans, and everybody should go and look at Keith's Gigapans. Neville Thompson has done some beautiful work too. He's part of the United Family of Anomaly Hunters, and Keith has done some stunning work recently. But when you crawl through this stuff, the spacing of these mounds, again, just seem human-like in their spacing and how you move through it. And the vistas, the sight lines, again, Richard, it's just familiar over and over again.
You know, one of the things I've gotten, we obviously have some time to get into this in the next half hour, but I've been watching this Traverse, the Curiosity rover's movement, slow movement up the slopes of Mount Sharp, and its Traverse almost looks like, and this is going to sound really strange, except maybe the Catholics in the audience, it almost looks like the seven stations of the cross. It looks like they're following a ceremonial route, and they're taking close-ups of ceremonial things that have great meaning. And it may just be that what Keith thinks is this plaque with some kind of a frieze on it, or some kind of a story, kind of comparing it to Mayan friezes. It may be that we have more than one of these in these canyons, curiosities wandering up, because some other civilization put them up as kind of like national park roadside rest markers to describe what this place is supposed to represent in Martian history. I mean, is that too much of a stretch, guys? Am I just reading like crazy into this? Chris, what do you think?
No, I don't think you are. It's not really a far stretch at all. Just looking at a lot of these pans, like Andrew just said about Keith Laney's as well as Neville's, you can see a lot of these things would look like buttes. I don't believe they're buttes at all. I think they're being covered up by the powers to be, so to speak. But we are seeing a lot of mechanical things laying around, which is more advanced. And we're seeing a lot of what look like ancient things laying around. So I don't believe it's a far stretch at all.
Interesting. What got you into this?
Well, I mean, even as a young kid, I was the same way. I was a big nerd then. I watched everything from Star Trek, Space 1999, Lost in Space, and stuff like that. And I wanted to be an astronaut when I was six. I'm sure a lot of people were like that.
When you were six, what were astronauts doing? What year was that?
Well, they were on the moon. I was born in 1966.
Oh my God, a kid born, but we never did not walk on the moon. Amazing. Amazing.
Exactly,
think
right?
about that.
Exactly. So, you know, when I seen this stuff, I was like, wow. And then I years later, I saw it on, I think it was in 2020 magazine, I believe it was, A Face on Mars. And of course, boom, it clicked. And I was like, what is going on here? I said, that is, oh my God, that's like astounding. And of course, they try to cover this up. I don't know if you've seen, I'm sure you've seen the latest one or the one they come out with years after that. It looked like some CGI model, didn't even look realistic at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going, no. I'm going to go by the Viking image. That's the very first one. I'm going to go by it. I believe that's real, realistic, and I believe that's real as opposed to the CGI. And then after that, it just caught the bug, and I've always been into it, anything space, so to speak, and up to this day. So that's how I became an anomaly hunter, and just something I love to do.
So, again, I'm going to ask this of everybody. Now that you know, based on the data, the evidence, that it's like 99.99% that we're not nuts, this stuff is real, how does that make you feel?
You know, Keith, Richard, I...
Hang on. I'm still working with Chris. So we'll get to you, Will. Don't worry. Chris?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead and ask the question again.
Well, it was like, how the fact that this is real now make you feel? I mean, here we are in the first decades of the 21st century, and suddenly 50 years after Star Trek goes on the air, damn it, we're in the midst of a bunch of ancient ruins, millions of years old, created by Pearsons or persons unknown, and somehow we're involved in it. It's like, how does that make you feel?
Well, I mean, it's pretty simple. I mean, it's just like this huge connection. I mean, it's just, I don't know how to explain it. It's just like, boom, it's like confirmed.
Oh, Andrew sent me a note. He says, it's like coming home.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You just feel so much of a part of that. And you just go, wow, I don't know. It's just natural, if you will. It's just, boom. You just go, wow, I just feel this huge connection.
See, I remember, I'm going to switch now to the other part of the pond. Robert, I remember an email from you way back when, and I had a lot of crazy emails, and yours struck me as not being crazy. You actually were asking really interesting questions, and then, for God's sake, you got bitten by the bug, and here you are. Your time, you're retired, you're focusing on alien ruins. Did you ever, in your wildest dreams, think it would turn out like this?
No.
So what did convince you that we were all not crazy? Because your first email was very logical, very skeptical, but very gentlemanly.
Oh, I'm still very skeptical, I suppose, but I can't remember that first email. And back to what was the question again, Richard?
Well, after all of this, because you got into this at a very, very early time when no one else was really patting you on the back except us crazies. Mm-hmm. Looking back now, with all this data, I mean, it's obvious we were right. Again, what do you think we're right about? What's your story kind of sketchily in your mind is to explain what we're seeing?
Well, there's so many scenarios that you could come up with. I suppose the face on Mars is suggestive that there's some kind of link between us and the civilization that we're putting on the planet. Because of the human and lion nature of what's in there in the face mm-hmm. image. But what the connection actually is, you know, you could come up with so many scenarios, which makes it so interesting. Because if, let's say, if it was confirmed in a 100% way that there's a civilization or an ex-civilization that was on Mars, then the effort that would have to be made to find out why and which is the proper scenario would be immense. You know, the amount of space exploration needed, the setting up of our own colony on Mars to explore it all, trying to coordinate everything between the nations of the Earth and private enterprise, you know, because it could turn into a real treasure hunt, you know, and what's there could be wrecked by us. So, yes. And of course, it would be public, you know, and so it wouldn't be in the hands of officials or politicians or military as much as it is now. The public of the Earth would want to be involved.
The thing that's so stunning, Robert, is that now when you and I started this stuff, along with Kinti and all the other folks that we were there at the beginning, we were looking at agencies like NASA or the Russians or ESA, the European Space Agency. Now, and that's the reason I put up Musk's stuff tonight in Radio with Pictures, now we're looking at private entrepreneurs like Bezos and Musk. And then there's the whole M drive aspect of this. It's not going to take a government. It's not going to take a village anymore, Hillary. It can take just a few of us crazies assembling resources, maybe having a pet millionaire or two, and we can go and find out everything we need to know, including maybe where the libraries are.
Yes. Well, in terms of the libraries, it would be good if they had something like their own equivalent of Wi-Fi internet, wouldn't it? Somewhere in a deep bunker on Mars, say there was a dormant servers there that have just, you know, gone into hibernation, and rather than searching the whole planet for a library, that if you found a way through pinging through some your own Wi-Fi somehow, that you could reactivate that and draw out the information somehow.
I have a feeling we're going to have to find something like crystals or some media, some technical mechanism that we plug into a machine that probably is there somewhere, you know, like a player. Because, again, if they built the face to let us know that this is where we should come back to figure out who the hell we are, don't you think they would have also thought about the idea of libraries and obsolescence of media and making as stupid simple as possible to figure out how to talk to that language, that archive?
Well, I think the two obvious places to look are the face, as you say, because it's attractive to us, so maybe there was an intention of leaving the face as a legacy to whoever came along afterwards, and Phobos, which is easier to reach, of course.
Yes, Phobos. What an amazing place to dock with. Okay, we got to move on because we're only a couple of minutes here to the bottom of the hour. Will, you're on deck. What got you into this crazy business?
Well, when I was young, I used to...
He's only in his ancient...
35.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I mean, my ancient 30s, mid-30s. I used to be able to astral travel when I was a younger child.
Oh, really?
I grew up trying to learn what that was. And I really ended up into the paranormal side of things more than space. So I'm actually coming at this from... I didn't watch Star Trek. I didn't watch Star Wars. I didn't have that conditioning that I think a lot of you guys have.
You poor deprived child. Oh my God, your parents should be taken out, and why didn't you watch any of this stuff?
Right. I was busy watching Unsolved Mysteries and all those type of shows at night, and that brought me in because they would bring these type of things up about, you know, like UFOs and things like that. But I never really did buy the whole, you know, gray type alien type thing. I've always felt like when we're talking Mars, that it was more personal. And the imaging that I finally started, I think I'm up to 660 videos now that I've done on various anomalies.
Only six more to go to the end of the world.
Yeah, I've pretty much proved to myself time and time again that it not only looks very familiar to what we do here. My next video is going to be I'm going to be taking Pumapunku, and I'm going to take it right up to a saw that I think was 618. It is the exact same ruins. I mean,
you know, I've seen so much on Mars that looks like Pumapunku, like just on Mars as opposed to on Earth. Okay, hold it there because we're coming down to the bottom of the hour. I need to do a couple of housekeeping things. We'll save Keith for after the bottom of the hour, and then we'll go looking at a couple of images as examples of things. Then I'm going to ask some really, really deep questions. So think about deep questions. I want you to, you know, think deep. If you want to join the conversation and send us a Facebook query or a Twitter question, obviously, upper left-hand side of the radio, of the other side of midnight.com, and there's our two little icons there. Click on those. And obviously, this is a program that you're going to want to listen to later, so you need to join Club 19.5 to do that. We have our own library, over 200 programs now, in a very interesting set of arcs and story ideas where we're trying to meld research so that when you listen to the archive, it's more than the sum of the parts. You're on the other side of midnight, live tonight on the radio, last morning of the week, Saturday morning, gorgeous moon up there, with my panelists and the future, we shall return.
I know you're out there somewhere, I know I'll find you somehow, and somehow I'll return again. Slowly, I can see the way, and I've left behind the empty streets that once inspired my life. And the strength of the emotion is like thunder in the air, 'cause the promise that we made each other haunts me to the end. I know you're out there somewhere.
Everybody's in.
And we are back with our last half hour here on a brilliant moonlit night here in the Land of Enchantment. It's going to get chilly. Oh my God, it's 42 degrees. The mysterious answer to everything in the universe. It's 42. Actually, you know, Stan Tenen told me once that that was actually true. The answer to everything is 42. And I'm not going to spoil the surprise. I'm going to have him come back on, and he will tell you why 42 is the secret to everything in the universe. So, given that we can't figure that out tonight, we're going to move back to our panelists. Keith, you're up. How the hell did you get into this? And given how much you've now looked at, let's start with everybody thinking about what does it mean? What's the story arc to describe what we're seeing on Mars in this amazing NASA data right now tonight?
Well, you know, Richard, I caught the exploration bug as a very young child sitting in front of a, oh gosh, the TVs we have nowadays are such a world better, sitting in front of a small, like 19-inch set, watching the Apollo missions and, you know, how grainy they were and how we were all riveted to it. You know, that's what first got me started, you know, because that spirit of space exploration was drilled into me at a very young age. And you know, as I got older and the data started getting better, you know, and then I saw you on CNN pointing at a face, I decided to look into the images, look into the whole thing. And, you know, it's been a learning experience, the whole thing is, because there's so much that you need to learn and know to be able to access the, you know, access the data and to get a good look, most importantly, a good honest look. You know, and so when I started looking into it, I started seeing signs that, you know, there might have been a civilization here. I looked at it like you, Richard. When I first saw the face, I said, oh, well, that's amazing, but there could not be. There's not such a thing.
No.
You know, that was my response. There's not such a thing. Let me look into this closer. And as I looked into it closer, the more and more I saw. And over the years, the data's gotten better and better, and to the point now where we're taking robots.
Well, you know what's so amazing?
Riding it right through an ancient city.
So amazing to me, Keith, is that for all its protestations, NASA has gotten, I don't know how many million press releases on Cydonia. And they keep saying it's a place that's not interesting. It's just, you know, water, you know, the edge of the so-called, what do they call it, hummocky terrain. They have a million excuses as to why it's not interesting, and yet it is literally the most photographed place of real estate on Mars, bar none. How do you explain that?
Because
they're lying.
They're the same way. They're like, no, there couldn't be. But let's look at it closely, because there might be. And you know, the recent attitude, you know, I'm just rolling through this ancient city and taking pictures, especially like this triangle thing. And you know, like Andrew says, the walls of faces. And might I say that most of the most well preserved stuff is on the southwestern facing sides of this stuff. I mean, that just, you know, when I'm looking at it, I look at the same type of scenes on Earth, you know, that are straight geology, and I don't see the same walls of faces. You know, yes, there are the pareidolia examples where, you know, I can look there and I can see a profile face on the edge of this rock, and I can see what may be an ersatz looking thing in the middle of this mesa, but it's nothing like this on Mars, where it's down the whole side of the darn thing, you know, from one side to the other. And you know, you can see what might be, you know, might be the remains of friezes on the walls and, you know, plastering. And you see where what wrecked this place, maybe the flood that deposited a bunch of silt everywhere. You see where its remnants are still clinging on, even though the rest of it has, by Aeolian action, been swept away. You see parts where we have masonry that's exposed out of this silt layer. Andrew did a real nice little display of one on the show last week or week before last. And you know, it showed the masonry that's behind the silt layer, and it's like Chris says, it's a lot more modern looking, you know, what's underneath. And so, you know, so what we're doing is going through here, and it's so hard to see for some people because it's half covered with this tenaciously clinging layers of silt, and you can see those fine plates of stuff that are dropping off of it, you know. But you know this is, to me, it makes more sense looking at it in an archaeological standpoint, because you see these faces, you see these sculptures, the soldier that's on the side of the mound number 4 that's, you know, as you go through this area. And you know what else? You raised an interesting point earlier that when you go through here and you see Mount Sharp in the backdrop of these large panoramas, you see where the hope it is a processional way.
I think it's a Stations of the Cross procession. They are following a ritual path.
Well, I mean, there's one of the gigapans that I've done, and I mean, I've done like 30 of them in this tour through the mountains area. There's like 33 of them, I think, total. As you know, I was doing these, you know, I'm seeing this in perspective, and looks like you've got two large statues, one on the left, one on the right, and then a series of mounds all geometrically spaced, one on the left, one on the right, a little further back, one on the left, one on the right, a little further back, and then framing the backdrop with Mount Sharp rising in the background. Well, to me, you know, if I was standing there looking at the Great Pyramid from, you know, with the Sphinx on one side and the other ruins on the left, right, you know, standing there on the plateau looking at Giza, like if it was still covered up, that's the same kind of feeling that I get, you know, the same kind of impression I get from those images, that this is a ceremonial place, and they're walking through there, and like you said, there's signs as you go by, and this might be the art and the heroes and so forth represented from one of these ages, and then you go down to the next one.
This is what I'm thinking, you know. In other words, I wanted to have a kind of a crack tonight. We're only going to get a first shot at this. We're going to do many more shows like this, but I wanted everybody to kind of give a big picture crack at what do they think happened. So, Keith, let's bring in Andrew next.
Oh, okay, there I am. Sorry. Be quick on the draw for that mute. Well, one thing, Richard, real quick, is like Keith said about the Egyptian material. When we look at this stuff, if we didn't tell people where it was, if we said, oh, look at this, I guarantee you that archaeologists would stand up and go, oh, wow, that's somewhere here on Earth. And the moment you say it's on Mars, oh, well, no, it can't be. So there's a whole barrier to bust through. We can't even take that step beyond this planet. What happened? Well, I mean, I'm convinced of the model that there was a great war, and that not only was a civilization broken, not only was a planet broken, but a solar system was broken and a physics was broken. And you've talked about this, Richard, and about how we might be now ascending and reclaiming that physics again, how we might be seeing a new physics come into place because it was broken. And we see evidence of this in ancient writings. There's one in particular, and I can't remember, but one of the, I think it's Sumerian, and it says, and they had to remeasure the deep after the war. I mean, I can't remember the title. I'm sorry. It fell out of my brain. But I think it was a great war, and I think it was wiped out. And one of the things that Keith and I talk a lot about
this is one of those Sumerian cuneiform texts that Sitchin has translated.
That's right, yeah. And I'm sorry, everybody, I can't remember the title. But
probably the Enuma Elish went on high.
Yes, yes, yes. But this stuff is proud and bold. This is not buried. This stuff is buried.
Well, it's
by,
not buried anymore because it keeps falling out of these cliffs. I keep watching this. It's like driving through Bryce Canyon or someplace here on Earth. And instead of just lots of rock, you've got rock surrounding technology and machinery and brackets and I-beams and all kinds of metallic structural stuff and who knows what else it's made of. And as the muds and the rocks, the sandstone is eroding, this hard technology is falling out. As I think it was Chris who said, there's junk all over the ground now.
Exactly. And it's proud, Richard. I just want to get this last bit in. The Candor Tetrahedron, when Keith pointed me at some of what we think, again, is sculpture, there, some of this stuff is pretty scary looking, and it is power. This is a culture of power. What exactly these people were doing, I don't know, but it had a lot to do with power.
Well, they may have wound up being stupid enough to blow up a whole solar system if their culture was oriented to power. See, I've always felt this was a civil war. I never felt we were looking at invaders. I always felt it was two sides of the super race, the gods, because we used to have these godlike abilities. If the physics is what I think it was back then. And can you imagine the Titanic, pun intended, clash between two sides of a super race? Have we seen any movies kind of laying this out over the last 10, 20, 30 years?
Richard, Disney CEO Bob Iger has confirmed another entry in the Star Wars series. They are going to keep rolling out our history right in front of our face.
As the reality. Okay, Will, what do you think happened?
Well, I think we're looking at maybe two or three happenings, just like here on Earth. I don't think we've actually learned our full, you know, when I look at some of the, let's just go down to the Mesoamericans, it looks like there's stuff on the bottom that's a lot more pristine than on top. So it looks like there had been generations after generations, and they just picked up where they left off and where they were lost. So I'm thinking when I'm going through these images, I feel, and it's more of a feeling, and you know, now I can actually see it, that we have stuff that's laying right on the surface that looks to be a little bit less, maybe oxen, you know, right. Not as much rust on it. But then we've also got these foundations and things like that we're finding that are pretty flat, very symmetrical, pretty much like we find here on Earth. So I'm thinking there may have been two or three happenings. And just like here on Earth, I think we always try and bounce back. The human race are, you know, and like I said, I just truly believe that they're not gray aliens that are were here.
Look at that thing that I think is a statue lying tipped over in the sand. That's not a gray alien. That's us.
Yeah.
That's an iconic ruler type image of a human being. Thomas, what do you think?
Well, what do I think? What happened on Mars? When we're looking at rover images, we must remember that we are seeing less than 1% of the Martian surface from the rover's view. And can we really say what happened to Mars by looking at less than 1%? Then we have the orbiter images saying that are covering a much bigger area. We actually have covered all the Martian surface. You can go to Google Mars and look at that. But that does not go deep enough to tell what actually happened. But I would like to talk about looking at the rover images and looking at that list, the one area of the Martian surface. I would say what we are seeing from the rovers are an area that either was there was a giant blast or catastrophe happened there, or there was a war of a kind and someone dropped a hell of a lot of bombs in that area or destroyed that area. What would be interesting would be when we get the new rover, 2020 rovers up there, and we get some new pictures that maybe can give us a new view of looking at it at. But for now, I would say that there was some kind of war up there. If it was invaders, I don't know. If it was a civil war, or I don't know. But something catastrophic happened on the Martian surface. And looking at all those rover images, it looks like, and I can't state this, I can only say what I think, it looks like it was one giant bomb that destroyed that area and destroyed what is there. And as Chris also said, it is a junkyard. Everything is spread all over yes, it is a big junkyard, and things has been laying there for hundreds, maybe thousands of years untouched. And I do believe that the civilization that was on Mars during that catastrophe or during those wars went underground, and I do believe that they are still down there underground, and we are only seeing just 1% of what we can see of evidence of a civilization on Mars from those images that NASA are giving us, even though they try to hide it as much as possible. But yes, my guess is there was some kind of war and something destructive happens on the planet.
So let me then ask everybody this question, and I want you to be really honest now. You've been at this now for decades. Your inclinations, your kind of whole bent of your life interest has moved in this direction. It's kind of like early warning search radar. You glommed onto this as a possibility. The data's now come in. It's almost inconceivable that it's not what we think it is. Has anybody had any dreams about being back there now?
Yep.
Okay, you want to tell us about them?
Well, I had, believe it or not, this is a funky dream. I had a dream that we actually went there because they want to send Martian people to Mars, I should say. And what was funny is if you've seen the movie The Martian, I don't know about you guys, but I was so disappointed with it because I expected to see some kind of like ancient something there that was intelligently made. And it was totally, you know, of course, we know who was kind of behind that. But the thing is, it's like I was expecting them to find this like the structure, like there was run down or beat up or something like that, and then find this is the dream I had that they actually found some building or structure, large structure, went inside it, and it had to happen to be some kind of like this elevator type thing, and they'd go down. This thing was still powered by like nuclear or some kind of other power source, and they would went underground, and there was this huge city. I mean, absolutely huge, where they were still living and thriving, and that the ground itself, like Thomas was just saying, that everything was nothing but destruction on the top. And that they found their way underground. Here's the thing. Even today, if we were hit by something catastrophic, some kind of celestial body had hit the Earth right now and just pretty much, you know, went into, just totally killed everything on the planet. We have structures. We have underground tunnels. We have all kinds of things. We got the seed vault. We got everything underground. We would still survive one form or another. So I think that's what they had done. Maybe they knew about this impending doom. Maybe they knew if it was a celestial body, that is, and if it was something that they'd done to themselves, you know, because there was traces of these huge areas of nuclear fallout, so to speak. So, yeah, I mean, one form or another, this planet was destroyed. And, you know, like I said, I think they still survived. I think they're still under there as we speak.
Do you know there were a couple of 1950s movies that had that as kind of the plot? Remember those B science fiction movies where guys from Earth go to Mars, land in a rocket ship, and they find this underground high-tech culture because there had been a war on the surface?
Yep.
Eerie.
Yep.
Anybody just jump in. Again, the thing that I'm struck by is how familiar things are. So then the question is, are, in fact, we merely replicating here what we used to do there? And if you extend that far enough, are we going to also replicate the stupid stuff we did that wound up with all the ruins we're seeing?
Richard, let me say this. I think we're seeing we're Martians one form or another. And what I mean by that is, if you look, and Andrew said this earlier, you've got the ancient Sumerians, which talked about there was the moon, Earth, and Mars was occupied all at the same time at one point in, you know, ancient times. So I believe that's the case. And something just went severely bad on Mars. Now, if you were to push that aside, I also believe in the theory of panspermia. You know what that is, right?
Yes, of course.
So you've got, for all the people who don't know, it's basically, you know, a planet, or Mars we're talking about, for an example, got hit by some celestial body, some kind of great cataclysm or something like that. Something happened. And, of course, you know, if it was hit by a celestial body, then all of these rocks and debris and everything else would go out into space, and of course it found its way here to Earth. Now, if there was some kind of living organisms, which they can survive in space, we know that now, and it was like building blocks of life there on Mars and somehow ended up here, well, this is how life started here. So I believe that either way, this is the reason why I say either way we're Martians, and I believe that the ancient civilizations like the Sumerians, I believe those texts are real. I mean, they're not just, I mean, did they have sci-fi writers back then, or was this something they wrote about?
Was it history, in other words? Anybody exactly. else? Jump in.
Yeah, I'd like to jump in. My sense of it is that intelligence is manifesting throughout universes. It's like a DNA imprint, if you will. And it's not only that are we the Martians, it's that it's all coming from the same field of consciousness. It's like a fractal pattern that's occurring over and over throughout the universes. And so, I mean, because before the Martians, who was there? You know, it's. I don't think it's just that we came from Mars. It's that we are coming from the same imprint, the same consciousness is manifesting. And yes, I do also think that they may have been aware that there would be problems, or they were, you know, colonizing Earth, that there was some connection, physical connection going on between Mars and the Earth. But I think that the genesis of intelligence is long before Mars. and has been traveling throughout the universes, and science is showing that microbia live throughout space. And I think that as our instruments become much more refined, we're going to see that the quantum intelligence is really indeed manifesting throughout the universe.
I would tend to agree. I think that we're looking at templates, kind of templates in the physics, in the field. I mean, when we found, based on the, which data? It was the, it was one of the two rovers. I think it was Spirit. When they found the little fossil, and then they ground it to dust on live television, it looked like an ancient life form in an ancient sea here on Earth. And if that's true, then you got to ask yourself, how did the DNA for that little creature arrive on Mars and independently create identical creatures in the oceans, the ancient, you know, 100, 200 million year oceans of the Earth? Is it possible that we're looking at the given DNA imprint spewed out again and again and again, and it replicates itself in whatever environment it can find, but Darwinian evolution is not part of the plan?
Yes.
I mean, that's what the data is looking like to me. It's like we used to drive, you know, Subarus and Caddies and Humvees on this damn place, and then we blew it up, and then we moved over, and we've been doing this same thing again and again and again because we're not learning anything. We have to short
circuit.
Anybody?
We are learning. I think we are turning a corner, and I think that's one reason why we are now focused on these artifacts. I think this is pushing us in the direction of a new choice. I don't think we're going to replicate destruction. That's where I stand.
Interesting. Okay. Darren's been trying to get in. Somebody wants to say something?
Yeah, wouldn't you? I've been thinking of this in retrospect, and when you consider this, we have possibly an ultra-high-tech civilization that left remnants on Mars due to some sort of cataclysm, okay? Well, but the things that we're driving by and looking at are reminiscent of statues and big stone structures. Wouldn't it be the ultimate irony that a high technological civilization is remembered only in its ancient ruins? Mm. Sort of like if our civilization disappeared and 10,000 years from now we have some other civilization sending craft around and observing this planet, and the only thing that they can find left from us is the pyramids
have seen in some of these images definitely what I think are blocks, huge megalithic blocks, like a megalithic kind of civilization, which I would look at as one of the later cultures that tried to recreate past glories, and they used the materials that they had available like we do. But I also see evidence of incredibly ancient high-tech stuff that's not rock, that's got to be metallic, that's got to be other materials, and it's pristine as the mud and the sandstone around it are eroding. It's like it was encased in the flood through the catastrophe of worlds blowing up in its, you know, backyard, and it's only now eroding out again so we can see what the really ancient high-tech stuff looked like. And it's all smashed because, of course, that was not a very good hair day.
Well, Richard, I think whatever we're dealing with here was so at one point so advanced that they were able to move moons into place to, you know, even here on Earth, where we have a perfect solar eclipse, perfect lunar eclipses.
The ambitious people.
Well, think about that. The moon is exactly the same size as the sun to create an incredible solar eclipse on the Earth, and that's just a random accident? So much data now that this solar system was rearranged. So what I'm looking at, though, in what we're seeing so far, the artistry, the statuary, whatever, I don't know whether we're seeing images of them, the ancient ones, the old ones, or we're seeing images of us created in the primeval Garden of Eden, which was Mars in this model, and then we blew it to hell in a handbasket, and that's the collapse story why we had to leave the garden. We drove ourselves out by our stupidity.
And now, Richard, we're going back to rebuild it.
Yeah.
Richard, the image, think of the end of Planet of the Apes and when Charlton Heston gets
yes,
off the horse.
Yes, mm-hmm. You damn yes. Idiots, you d- that kind of thing. Okay, yep. We're at the end of the show. Let me do some promos here. Next week, you're all going to be back Friday morning, not Saturday morning, Friday morning. We have a live gentle crash landing of Rosetta on the Comet 67P, the place that's not a comet. So we're going to narrate that live to everybody around the world. Also, we're going to narrate it on satellite, because beginning on Monday night, Tuesday morning, our debate panel following the debate between Hillary and Trump, we're going to be going up on satellite, available to something like 2,000 GCN, Genesis Communication Network affiliates. So spread the word. The Other Side of Midnight is going to space for real. And with that, nice. Our music ends and begins, and a week ends and begins, and everybody pay attention next week. We are going boldly where someone has gone before. So until then, remember, same time, same bat channel. And until then, third star on the left, straight on till morning. We're going home. Good night, everyone.